So I'm Rick Hansen. This is the 14th, right, of November 2012. And I want to continue the exploration with you about refuges. We started talking about that last week. Refuges have sort of a fancy sound to it. Think about things that give you a cozy, comfortable feeling. Going into the bathroom and closing and locking the door. Even if the preschoolers are pounding on it, you're protected inside. Maybe it's a favorite book. For me growing up, dinner time was a time of refuge because in my really sweet and also curious family growing up, my mom went to her bedroom to read a book with a TV dinner. My dad went to the family room with his TV dinner to watch TV, and therefore everybody left me alone with my book and my TV dinner. So that was a form of refuge for me. I meditate in the morning often, and our cat, will crawl into my lap. I do catitation, and that's a form of refuge. I feel good with my little cat right there, making a cup of coffee or looking out the window, lifting your eyes above the horizon line, whatever it is. There are many forms of refuge. Traditionally, in Buddhism, there are the three classic refuges of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, which can be understood in a variety of ways. I think the simplest way to understand it is the teacher, the teaching, and the community of the taught. There are other refuges, of course, reason, science, ESPN, YouTube, good music, good chocolate, your friends, your family. Those are refuges as well. There are, of course, also problematic refuges. Some people have found their refuge in the bottle, or the refrigerator, or the mall, or in getting angry and carrying that anger around with them. We're going to find one refuge or another. In this life, we all need something to lean on. The question is, what will we lean on? Will we lean on those things that create suffering and harm for ourselves and others? Or will we find protection in, sanctuary in, inspiration from, refueling, replenishing from things that are more wholesome? So that's what I'd like to explore with you through the remainder of the year. It's a subject that's, for me, really sweetly integrated, both lofty and very, very practical and down to earth. So today, I'd like to explore the second of the classic three jewels or three refuges in Buddhism, the Dharma, and what that means. The word Dharma essentially means truth, both the reality of things, whatever it is, and the accurate description of that reality. There are many kinds of truths. And when I was reflecting on this talk, I thought about things that were truths for me when I was younger that I took refuge in. And I'll give you three examples. One is that around my home, where I grew up, in suburban Los Angeles, these were tract homes laid down on top of orange groves. Periodically, we'd have orange trees shooting up through the dachandra soil. I always liked it when they did that somehow. And then there were hills around my home. So I spent a fair amount of time in the hills or in these vast orange tree groves before they were all cut down for strip malls and roads and schools and homes. Okay. In those natural environments, there was a felt sense of sanity. Whether it was the smell of the oranges on the ground, or seeing new things grow up, or a sense of the rhythm of the seasons, or the feeling that I was in a larger whole as I saw the deer, or the squirrels, or the signs of coyotes. That gave me a sense of truth. There was the truth of nature, a reliable truth amidst many things that were not so reliable in my life as a kid. Another refuge for me growing up, and I, by the way, invite you to reflect on your own refuges of truth, discovering things that were true, that you could count on to be true, or to be true in a particular way, or to have a particular truth about them. Another one for me was science fiction. I stumbled across science fiction. I can still remember going to these used bookstores where paperback books were an expensive nickel each. This would be like early 60s. And suddenly I found that there was this world of reason where people could figure out things, where facts mattered, or logic was persuasive, and individuals could take action in reasonable ways and produce good results. Like, that for me was a refuge, a vision of what was possible. It was true that that was possible. And then another refuge for me related to truth as a kid was that I knew it was true that they were nuts, not me. I was messed up. I knew it was also true that I was squirrely as all get out, a deeply neurotic, nerdy, anxious kid. But I knew fundamentally that they were nuts, not me. And sometimes children have to make a fateful choice. Do they determine that they're nuts or I'm nuts? And I think typically kids make the wrong choice and conclude that they're nuts, rather than the other kids, the family environment, the crazy culture, late-stage capitalism, whatever. They conclude that they're nuts. And somehow, fortunately, I knew in my heart that they were nuts, not me. I still had an enormous amount of work to do to put that sanctuary of knowing into practice. But it served me enormously to know that that was true. So I invite you to reflect on what you yourself might have found as a refuge for you growing up that you knew was true. Then, through adulthood, I discovered other things that were true of various kinds. For example, I discovered that pursuing various pleasures, pleasures of the flesh, pleasures of the mind, pleasures in righteousness, pleasures in holding on to grudges, pleasures in pursuing winning at all costs, had a lot of cost to them. I discovered also that it was true that if you sustained effort and just kept plugging away, you could usually make a good thing happen. It wasn't a guarantee, but there was a relationship between effort and results. Right? That was the truth. That's the truth. I also learned that there was a truth of your own experience as I reclaimed my experience. You know, literally there was a truth below the neck. Who knew? You know, as I entered young adulthood, living utterly above, you know, my head and above, I found out that there was a whole truth down here of emotion and sensation and desire and intuition and a kind of reclaiming of that truth. How's that been for you to reclaim that truth? And, you know, what could remain for you about claiming that? I found that when I spoke that truth, first to myself, and named the truth of my own experience, my own actual sensations, my own, how it actually is to be this guy right here, right now, when I did that for myself, when I owned that truth, it was enormously liberating. And then when I found slowly, but eventually surely, the courage to speak my truth to other people, you know, in appropriate ways, and there was to name my experience to other people, that had actually remarkable authority to it and was the opposite of feeling fragile or weak or vulnerable. But it actually felt really, really freeing to be able to claim that truth in relationship with other people. Request, if you don't mind, to close that door, one of you who's nearby there. Just not a deal. I also learned to claim the truth of just what would make life a little easier. You know, like close a door or turn down the TV or turn up the TV or, you know, get gas now rather than later because then I won't worry about it. So whatever works. Along the way, I also discovered the truth of the Eastern philosophies, including in particular Buddhism. And the central truth taught by the Buddha is the truth of impermanence. That's really the core of the Dharma. The truth of impermanence. Now, that truth is particularly applied to our experience, because that's what the Buddha was primarily interested in, our actual experience, the realm of phenomenology, in other words, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, and smells, and thoughts, emotions, desires, memories, images, dreams, reflections, and all the rest of it. That's what he was especially interested in. He acknowledged change out in the world, and he talked about change out in the world. For example, in the Vedic culture of his day and in his own teaching, the metaphor of fire is used routinely. flames flickering, fires arising due to causes, their fuel, and when the fuel runs out, there's no more fire. The central aspiration in Buddhism, Nibbana, Nibbida, the root of that is to extinguish, to blow out, like a fire that no longer has any fuel. In other words, there's no longer any cause of suffering. So there's an end to that natural process as a result. So the Buddha routinely drew upon metaphors from the natural world, and he was certainly grounded in the natural world. But his primary interest was our own experience. And with regard to our experience, we know it well, the sensations of breathing, the movements of thought, the sharpening and dulling of attention, what it feels like to want water when we're thirsty, love for others, the sense of compassion, the sense of contraction and loneliness, what have you, we know that moment to moment it's continually changing. That's the central truth that's available to us experientially, particularly clearly in formal meditative practice. It's easy to forget that things are continually changing when we're just hanging out or talking or kind of lost in thought. Because then the mind, for survival purposes, tends to reify things, turns them into things that seem to endure. If you watch your own experience, particularly if you're just daydreaming and then rewind and replay, you'll see that in that was a whole essentializing of things, turning fluid processes into static entities again and again and again, because that's somehow what we can cling to, right? But in the actual, when you're really present with yourself, like in meditation, you can see that things are just changing and changing and changing and changing. What's the takeaway from that? You know, that goes to the second major characteristic of the three characteristics the Buddha identified, the first being change, the second being that there's no abiding self. The self is defined, the psychological self, the sense of I, or me or mine. It's defined as enduring and unified. That's its definition. But in a context in which everything is changing, there's no enduring I looking out behind the eyes. The apparent I that looks out through the eyes is continually different. It's different today than it was yesterday. It's really different than it was in the past. There's a certain stability in the sense of a standing wave, the river moving over the boulder. But we can know, as we look at that standing wave, the river moving over the boulder, that even if it has a certain, somewhat static quality, it's inherently very fluid and fundamentally not static at all. So when we look closely at our experience and we track the impermanence of it, right there that undoes the sense of being an entity, an I. That's true too. Which then takes us to the third truth, the third characteristic that the Buddha identified to existence as psychological beings, which is that when we cling to things that are changing and when we act as if we are a static, enduring, unified entity, an I, we create suffering and harm because we're at odds with the truth of things. And thus, we find ourselves in the third characteristic of existence, suffering. So here we have the three characteristics, right? Anicca, impermanence, anatta, no abiding psychological self, and dukkha, the suffering that results when we forget the truth of the first two. On the other hand, the truth is also, and the Buddha demonstrated this in his life, this was his testimony to the world. And if you read the discourses from the Buddha, when he talks about his own hard-won realization, his own insight, there, to me, a very inspiring sense, there's the triumphant quality of having overcome or seen through the clouds, the mysteries. And there's a joyfulness of realizing, wow, I don't have to be trapped in this suffering. I actually can practice in such a way that I can create causes in my mind, which really means in my body and brain. I can create causes that enable me to truly flow with the stream of things, not presuming that I'm a static self, continually living life in letting go. Enjoying what's pleasant that flows through, living with, coping with, tolerating what's unpleasant that flows through, but throughout living in truth, living in the truth of transience and interdependent arising. People in the time of the Buddha who identified themselves as Buddhist did so related to a fundamental saying. And the fundamental saying is all that arises dependently shall dependently pass away. That's how people were defined as Buddhist, as those who recognized that truth. That's how central the recognition of truth is to Buddhist practice. So you might ask yourself, how closely in harmony do you live with that truth? The truth of transience, the truth of the inherent passing of experience, and a sense of the futility of seeking fundamental happiness in clinging to any kind of experience, which is insubstantial and washes right through our fingers in the moment of grasping after it. You know, how closely do we live in harmony with that truth? To what extent do we let that truth live us? And I think in a lot of ways, what we do in practice is we gradually help ourselves live more and more immediately and intimately present in this truth. We don't do it perfectly. It takes a while. We have to work at it. But we increasingly find ourselves in this truth as a great refuge, a source of sanctuary, because it takes us right out of suffering, the suffering that comes from clinging and grasping. Now, there are other truths as well that are refuges. And I want to talk about a couple different ways to know what's true for you, what you really find truthful. Interestingly, in the brain, it has two frames of reference for what's true. One frame of reference is, you could call it, egocentric, in a neutral sense. It's in reference to this perspective. And then another kind of truth-knowing in the brain is called allocentric. In other words, from a impersonal, sort of bird's-eye view perspective. And interestingly, the brain, based on a little switch in the thalamus, which is the central switchboard in the brain, continually switches back and forth from these different ways of orienting to the world, including the world of our own experience, moment to moment. Several times a minute, the brain naturally cycles between allocentric, impersonal, big picture, not privileging any perspective, to egocentric, what's the world look like in terms of what's relevant to me personally, back into allocentric, just seeing things as a whole, back to egocentric, what's this got to do with me, right? Several times a minute. That's a natural process. And interestingly, research is showing that by doing meditative practice, particularly present moment focused meditative practice, so we're really in the present, letting experience wash through us without clinging to it, a little bit as if time's flowing through us and in the windshield of time, in this moment, we notice what's there and then it's gone, that practice actually strengthens the circuits in the brain that support the allocentric perspective, the impersonal, big picture, inclusive perspective that doesn't privilege our particular point of view and therefore tends gradually to undermine a sense of self-referential me, myself, and I. Pretty good. Now, that said, there is a place for the egocentric perspective, for the knowing of how something is from your own perspective, how it actually is landing for you, especially if, whether it's growing up or culture or gender socialization or life experiences, particularly if you've been disempowered some in claiming your own perspective, in speaking truth to yourself, if to no one else, as to what your own experience actually is and what it's actually like to be you. There's a place for that perspective. If you've noticed the experience, you're with people, and let's suppose they just absolutely will not communicate a first-person perspective, you know, how it actually is for them and their experience. It's like talking to a robot. You know, you just want to smack them upside the head. I encountered some people like this in my sort of New Age background sometimes, or people who are just like totally in their head up. They have a really hard time claiming their own experience. So there's a place for people to claim their own experience. So for a moment here, I invite you to, we'll just be quiet, and I'd like you to reflect on your life right now, or maybe even, this year, 2012 altogether, and ask yourself, what's something, or what are some things that are really appropriate and wholesome for you to know to be true from your perspective? What's important to let it sink in how you actually see things and what you see from your vantage point? Or what's really wholesome or useful to sink in how certain things have affected you? So I'll be quiet for half a minute or so. In other words, what's something or some things that are important to know that they matter to you? And then you can imagine, like, how it might serve you to take refuge in knowing that those things are true. Let's take a different perspective, though. Like, imagine your life from a more detached perspective. I do it sometimes by imagining I'm looking at my life in a corner, an upper corner, in some room I'm in, you know, looking this away, decentering, if you will. And if you were to look at your family or your career and work, or if you were to observe the being who wears your name tag in a kind of detached way, what truths are worth recognizing, both for the welfare of that one who wears your name tag and other beings? So here too, I'll be quiet for about half a minute. One way I try to, you know, come to terms with this question myself, the second one, the more allocentric perspective, is to ask myself more, you know, what does the situation call for? What's possible, what's not? Like, for example, there are people celebrating upstairs. It's the way it is. Nothing to do about it, you know, so that's a more objective way of looking at things. I can look at my family, our two young adult kids living with us. I can look at their lives or our family harmony, or, you know, could step back and look at the planet altogether. You know, what's it need? What's the situation need? What's the company need? What's the family need? What's this relationship need? What does Thanksgiving need to be happy next week, for example? Okay? And then I'll do one last one. I find this one really sweet. Okay? What's the truth of some of your good intentions? I had a kind of epiphany last week. I was bothered by something, and even though rationally I knew there was no need to be bothered by it, that I actually had not screwed up, and that there were actually not going to be repercussions, you know, my two big fears, and then actually I was not going to look like a fool, my third big fear. Actually, I was still bothered by it, and I realized, related to some other things, that I was judging myself in terms of the sense of competence. Was I, had I been competent? And more painfully, did I look competent? And those have been major strivings for me, right? But as the Buddha said in his own, related to his own awakening, he said, I recognize the gratification, the danger, and the escape. The gratification in holding on to various things in the flow of life, and yet the danger in doing so. And then the escape. And my own version of that was not so lofty last week, but it was very powerful for me. It came to me, curiously, even as I was grappling with feelings of inadequacy or and worry and feeling bad, that kind of in a flash, I began to be to recognize a lot of different ways in my life I have had good intentions. That was a fact. Performance or competency is very, it's a very shaky ground, right? Because you could always be more competent, or you're only as good as your last movie. I learned that in LA, right? Your last performance. It's a very unsteady basis for deep feelings of peacefulness and worth. But to recognize your own good intentions and to found your own sense of worth and happiness and well-being more on a sense of and a recognition of your good intentions, and frankly, holding yourself to having good intentions rather than fleeting performances of various kinds. Wow, that was really kind of a breakthrough for me. And it's been carrying me along ever since. So ask yourself, what are the truths of some of your own good intentions? Your good intentions these days, the good intentions, the good purposes, the good aims, the good values, the good commitments, the good resolves that you have had in your life to this point. And see if you can let it sink in and open and soften around letting yourself enjoy these truths and taking refuge in the truth of your good intentions. So I'll be quiet again for half a minute or so. you might ask yourself, what would it be like to take refuge in my good intentions and take refuge in the fact of my good intentions? And then the last thing I'll say before some discussion here is that one of the things that often happens when we grow up or go through life in general is we come to doubt our own ability to see what's true. Maybe even we even lose touch with our capacity to discern what's true, what's actually the case. Not necessarily ultimate reality, whatever that is, but the basics, like, do I have good intentions? Is this other person fundamentally on my side or not? What happens when you don't brush your teeth? You know, some basics about what's actually true. And I think that often in more disturbed families, there's a real undermining of the capacity of people to say the truth. Or if a person has belonged or been part of a historically disempowered or disenfranchised group, poor people, heavier people, women, gays, people of color, older people, it's often that your truth gets ignored or bypassed. And then after a while, you just kind of give up on it yourself. And part of the journey of life in some ways, and it's very clearly the Buddha's journey, is to claim the truth again. And above all else, claim your capacity to discern the truth eventually, because that's the basis of everything else. Any discussion? Question or comment? Yeah.
What's the escape?
The escape, the danger, the gratification, the danger, the escape. The escape is meant in a positive sense, as in basically it means not craving, you know, or standing in truth that recognizes that it's all whooshing past us at the lip of the waterfall and now, and life goes best if we don't reach over and try to clutch at what's gone over the edge. That's the escape. And the cultivation, gradually over time, the gradual transformation of body and mind, you know, one synapse at a time, one thought at a time, one intention at a time, one breath at a time, that too is where the escape can be found, which is a very positive thing to realize that one little midgy step at a time, we make our escape. Okay. Anybody else? Great. Oh, great. Yeah, thank you for being so eloquent there, too, about this. And to realize that, you know, often all we can take refuge in is this breath and how we orient to it. And then we find the next moment. And also in the last week, I've had a series of email exchanges with someone I know is a very fine person who's just shattered right now. psychologically, and in enormous pain for a variety of reasons. And literally all she can do is to abide through this breath and then start again. And that's sometimes the only thing you can do. And in the awareness of the breath, too, if you will, or the thoughts that are present. So yeah, to me it's really important to know what you're, to be able to find those refuges for what you can do, and also recognize, wow, there's so much you just can't do. Yeah. One more person, then I'll wrap up with you tonight. Oh, I see. So,
from a neurochemical
it's a fine question. So, when we do experience some quality of relief or refuge, and again, there are many pathways to it, right? Some of them can be simply an almost philosophical recognition, let's say, of just change. Others can be, you know, if you had some sense, for example, of what's been there for me recently, this sense of your own goodness, in spite of all the naysayers, in spite of all the lack of competence or performance, but to know your own unconditional natural goodness, that's very intimate. You know, it's very at the quick of the being. Okay, that's very felt. However you come home to refuge, right? You're right, in the body, it takes us out of agitation and draws the body-mind back into what I've called the responsive mode, which is the natural recovery state of body and mind, where we come out of stressful fight-or-flight reactions, we repair and refuel the body, and the mind defaults to a good place of basic peacefulness, happiness, and love, right? And when we do that through, let's say, taking refuge or taking refuge in something, whether it's petting a cat or having a cookie, physical pleasure is a refuge. It's a major way to get out of these reactive bursts and into the long tail of the Mother Nature's blueprint, which is a long recovery phase. Pleasure is good. Feeling cared for or feeling caring is the second profound way to do that. And third, any way of coming back into balance in the body. You know, warming up if you're shivering or cooling off if you're sweating. Even though they're in opposite directions, they return you to homeostasis. They bring you back to balance. Any one of those will start triggering natural opioids, pleasure molecules in the brain, because it's a reward signal. Mother Nature wants us to be rewarded for coming out of these reactive bursts into our home base of the responsive mode of the brain. Mother Nature wants us, have you ever noticed that refuge feels good? You know, you walk into these spaces and it just feels like, ah. You come home from a long trip, plop your suitcases down, ah. You know, I've lived in Marin for 30 years. Every time I come through that tunnel, you know, the rainbow tunnel, I think, how cool, how badass to paint a tunnel with a rainbow, and I feel good. You know, that's my refuge, Marin, kind of this little port in my personal storms. You know, when that happens, you're right. It feels rewarding. It's supposed to feel rewarding. It's okay to take pleasure in those rewards and to let them guide you like a searchlight. You know, if you're a ship far at sea and there's storms and fogs, but you start tracking that light. I think that's a lot of what life practice does. We're looking for searchlights out in the stormy seas. And then when we find them, we often can't go directly at them. We have to tack back and forth. But we keep them in mind and we keep following them home. How about we sit with this for a minute or so and we'll wrap up. weeks ahead as we explore the theme of refuge, you might ask yourself from time to time, what are your own lighthouses that indicate refuges for you that you can follow home? You all are one of my lighthouses. See you next week, I hope.